This week on the Allegheny Front, a Pennsylvania family fights a pipeline company, threatening to cut down the maple trees that were to be their livelihood.
Last time they were here, I gave them maple candy, and this time they returned with assault rifles.
And 500 trees fell to chainsaws.
We're devastated by this, but we're not going to leave. This is our home.
1,000 miles away in Louisiana, a man faces the impacts of a drilling accident.
He had a gas monitor in his garage. That's how much he didn't want to leave his home.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're featuring two stories from two podcasts about how environmental policy changes lives.
What took his community away was not the presence of government, it was the absence of government to regulate industry.
Stay with us. The Hollerins said they didn't want a pipeline on their land and thought that was the end of it. They were wrong. A federal judge eventually gave the pipeline builder a chunk of the Hollerins' land, and acres of maple trees soon fell to chainsaws. But this story would take an unexpected turn, one that the family hopes might allow them to get their land back one day. In a recent episode of Energy Explained, a new podcast from State Impact Pennsylvania, Megan Hollerin tells her family's story to State Impact's Susan Phillips.
Consider how many things you fought over with your family from the time you were a kid. Maybe wanting a new bike, new shoes, or fighting with your parents about how late you stayed out. Even as an adult, maybe disagreements over politics or a career choice. But then there's Megan Hollerin, who says,
I've never fought with my family until this.
So before we get to the issue that made her fight with her parents for the first time, you need to know that Megan grew up in a rural part of Pennsylvania, a place called New Milford in Susquehanna County. It's about 160 miles north of Philadelphia. Her family's land, 23 acres bought by her grandparents in the 1950s, is about 2 miles up a dirt road past fields and forests. And Megan is an archaeologist. It was back in the summer of 2012 when the family was preparing to turn the land into a maple tree farm. Some of the trees were more than 200 years old. At that time, Megan was working for a contractor surveying land for a nearby pipeline. And she got a call from one of her friends who had been at a party at her house that weekend. Megan told me the story about that day on the phone from Nevada, where she's now working on an archaeology project.
And they called me up and said, you know, hey, we're working at your house today. I'm pretty sure this is your place. We were all here for a party over the weekend. And I didn't really believe them. I thought that they must have had some sort of mistake, but it turns out that was true. And that was in spring, summer of 2012 was when we first found out about it.
Wow. So you were actually working as an archaeologist.
That's a lot of what I do is work for things like pipelines and big contracts, construction jobs that are going to disturb the ground. They send us out first. And I happened to be working on that project when we found out it was going through my property.
Wow. That's kind of amazing. So why did they start working on your property without even telling you? Is that normal?
I mean, I guess they had sent out a letter that said, you know, Williams Corporation would like to do some surveys for an upcoming project on your property.
And that day, when Megan first found out there might be a pipeline coming through her family's land, that would turn out to be the root of the family's arguments to come. The pipeline builder, Williams, wanted to build a line they named the Constitution Pipeline through the burgeoning maple syrup farm. That was the first you heard that this actual pipeline was going through.
Yeah, it was the first that, you know, I went to my family after talking to my crew, my colleagues, and said, you know, this is a really big pipeline project, and I'm pretty sure we don't want it. Have you guys heard anything about it? And that was when my one aunt, who actually lives on the property, said, you know, I got a letter about something a while ago, but I didn't realize that this was what it was. And that was when we were able to start finally, you know, trying to look into it and figuring out, wait, what's going on here? What is this project? And we don't want it on our land.
And that was 2012.
Yeah.
That's 6 years ago. So this has been going on for a long time. Did they finally show up at your house and ask you to sign on the dotted line and offer you money?
Yeah, so eventually, you know, finally a land agent reached out and said, here's what the project is, here's the kind of right-of-way we want, and here's what we need from you to get permission. And at that point, they just said, you know, no, we don't think we want it. We could talk about maybe moving it somewhere else on the property. But ultimately, those negotiations came down to just like, no, we don't want that here.
How much money did they offer you?
It was ridiculously low. So there was a really long period of time where there wasn't really any contact going on between my family and between Williams, because we just kind of thought that was the end of it. You know, we'd said no, we said we didn't want it.
So when did it rear its ugly head then?
Oh, man, I guess it was in the spring of 2014 when they really started pushing, we actually are going to put the pipeline here, and if you guys aren't going to allow us to, we're going to take it by eminent domain.
Okay, a few words about eminent domain. The Hollerins are just one family among hundreds across rural and increasingly suburban Pennsylvania who find themselves battling pipeline companies through eminent domain takings. And eminent domain is allowed when a project is determined by a court to be in the public's interest. But Megan says the pipeline does not serve the public good. She says the company wants to ship the gas overseas. Not something worth sacrificing their maple syrup farm for. The company, Williams, disputes that. It says the gas would never go overseas. It would serve residents of New England, who often get stuck with big heating bills in the winter. When the threat of eminent domain loomed over the family, that's when they learned about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. Now, that's an important agency of the federal government. FERC has the power to decide if an interstate natural gas pipeline can be built.
Later on, we started filing all sorts of things with FERC as soon as we realized how that process works. And I don't know if you've ever tried to file anything with FERC, but it's not very intuitive and it can be very complicated to do.
So this bureaucratic battle lasted several years and put stress on Megan, her parents, her aunts and cousins, who all owned parts of the land. In the meantime, they began buying equipment to start tapping their maple syrup trees. But battling FERC wasn't going so well.
Well, the difficult part about it is that it's really hard to figure out what you're supposed to do to fight it, right?
For pipelines, states have to weigh in on environmental permits. The company got what it needed from Pennsylvania, but it looked like New York was dragging its feet. The pipeline path runs 90 miles through New York State, close to the upper part of the Delaware River. New York stalled on issuing permits, and that gave the Hollerin family some hope. The case got tied up in court, and the family at this point was united in fighting eminent domain through legal methods, but a federal judge in Scranton sided with the company.
The judge granted them their immediate access to the property, granted them their eminent domain and said, you guys have immediate access. Just go ahead and do whatever you want.
The first thing the pipeline company wanted to do was cut the maple syrup trees. So they went to the federal agency, FERC, for permission. The Hollerins fought that. They brought up the case of New York, which hadn't yet granted any permits. They pleaded for more time. Just wait, they said, until New York makes its decision. But FERC came down on the side of the company. The reason? Williams was working under a tight deadline to clear trees before migratory birds and bats returned in the spring. Federal law protects the bats and birds after they start nesting and raising their babies. The trees had to go, and they had to go quickly. When crews showed up in February 2016, they were met with protesters, both family members and pipeline opponents from across the state. The tree cutters backed off. So the company went back to the federal courthouse in Scranton. And the court came down hard on the family, telling them that they could go to jail or face heavy fines if anyone, whether they were family members or not, prevented the tree cutters from doing their jobs. At this point, some family members wanted to back down. And here's where the arguments between Megan and her parents began.
We got into these high-stress situations of, you know, just Everyone trying to figure out what the best thing to do is and no one really being sure and, you know, all of us being pretty strong-willed.
Megan wanted to continue the protest. She thought no matter what the judge said, she had a First Amendment right to do so. But the rest of the family were worried. They didn't want to go to jail and they couldn't afford a criminal attorney. The judge ordered the tree cutting to continue under armed guard. So on March 1st, 2016, just as the Hollerins were preparing to tap their trees for maple syrup, the tree cutters returned.
Last time they were here, I gave them maple candy, and this time they returned with assault rifles.
That's right. Semi-automatic weapons defended the tree cutters from Megan and her family. About half a dozen federal marshals in bulletproof vests and helmets greeted them that morning. And we traveled to the farm that day to report on the story.
Whether you're pro-pipeline, anti-pipeline, pro-gas, anti-gas, it doesn't really matter. You should be terrified by this situation.
Despite the arguments, the Hollerins followed the judge's orders. They did a few things to protest. They painted the trees red, white, and blue stars and stripes. But they also locked up the family dogs, fearful that the marshals might shoot them. And standing at a safe distance, Megan did get a few words in.
Thanks for not shooting anybody today.
Feeling unable to resist, Megan and her family watched as 558 trees were cut over the next several days. It was the end of their maple syrup dream.
We're devastated by this, but we're not going to leave. This is our home. They're taking about 90% of our maple trees on this property. So yes, all the potential we had to make maple syrup here on this property is being destroyed right now.
No money had exchanged hands, but here's how Megan described negotiations with the company.
The best way to quantify it is to think of it in terms of someone saying they're taking your land from you forever, and in response, they're offering you the price of a new truck.
But this story has a particularly devastating twist. It turns out the Hollerins were right about New York State. About a month after the trees were cleared, in a move that surprised everyone, FERC, the company, the courts, New York's environmental regulators refused to grant Williams water crossing permits for the Constitution pipeline. And today, more than 2 years later, despite the best efforts of the pipeline company, it appears that line will never be built across the Hollerins' land.
It's just been a lot of uncertainty and a lot of stress and just a lot of sleepless nights over something that, you know, it never needed to happen in the first place.
Right. So how does it look right now? I mean, what's going on on the land now?
It's a mess. Since they clear cut the trees, there's just this giant empty swath that, you know, used to be forested. And so it looks very bare and very stark.
What are the options going forward if they never build the pipeline?
We're hoping we get the possession of the land back and then, go to court and try to determine what they have to pay us in damages, you know, just for not only to try to restore the land as best we can, but also just for, you know, having basically rented it for 6 years without ever paying any rent on it, you know.
Do you have any idea how much that's worth at this point or how you even calculate that?
Well, I'm going to start by the cost of transplanting one 50-year-old tree, and then I'm going to multiply that by 500.
The company, Williams, says it still plans to build the pipeline. But the Hollerins' attorney says that's unlikely. Still, if the company won't give the land back, and FERC and the courts don't make them, those 5 acres of land running across the Hollerins' property will be owned by the company in perpetuity, for them to do with it what they want, including selling it to another pipeline company. So this month, the Hollerins filed a lawsuit in federal court to get their land back and get compensated for the taking. Megan's mother, Catherine Hollerin, told the court the ordeal, quote, took an enormous emotional toll on the family. In the meantime, Megan says they're still close. But she wonders if only she had prevailed in the argument with her parents. If she had sat up in the trees that day and stayed up there for 5 weeks and gone to jail, faced a fine, just maybe the trees would still be standing. No more crowbars to my head.
Susan Phillips is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania and produced that story for their podcast, Energy Explained. It's a podcast where they go behind the news to explain Pennsylvania's energy economy. Other episodes are online at State Impact Pennsylvania. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Our Trump on Earth podcast is not really about President Trump's opinions or beliefs about how to manage forest fires or whether global warming is happening.
I believe there's weather, I believe there's change, and I believe it goes up and it goes down and it goes up again.
Instead, Trump on Earth looks at how Trump's ideas and his administration are changing environmental policy.
As we speak, we are preparing new executive actions to save our coal industry and to save our wonderful coal miners from continuing to be put out of work.
So tune in to the Trump on Earth podcast for insights from journalists, scientists, and people who are curious about what's going on behind the splashy headlines and tweets. Episodes are at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. What can we glean from the midterm elections about what Americans want when it comes to the environment? Initiatives to tax carbon in Washington and regulate fracking in Colorado failed. The Democrats won a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, and some of those candidates ran on issues like clean energy. For some, the midterms were a referendum on President Trump and his policies. So what do Trump supporters think about the environment? The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looked into it last fall on our Trump on Earth podcast.
Louisiana is in many ways a beautiful, vibrant state, but it has big problems. It's one of the poorest states in the Union. It ranks 49th out of 50 states in the Human Development Scale from the Social Science Research Council. The Annie E. Casey Foundation ranked the state 49th out of 50 states for child well-being. It's losing a football field an hour of coastal wetland to rising seas and has one of the highest cancer rates in the U.S. and, oh, by the way, is near the top in toxic waste disposal per square mile. One way to solve these problems, one could say, could be more government intervention for things like education, job training, and environmental protection. But that's the last thing many in Louisiana want to see. The state is deep red and a haven of the Tea Party. In 2011, sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild decided to go there to study the modern conservative movement, in particular how rank-and-file members of the Tea Party viewed environmental issues. After 5 years, she produced Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Basically, it's an intellectual reconstruction of how the worldviews of conservative Louisianans were shaped. Arlie Russell Hochschild joins me now. Welcome.
Hi there.
So let's get into your book. Can you explain what you were trying to get at? What was the central question that you wanted to answer?
Right. I started with what I thought of as a red state paradox. And it's this. Why would it be that across the nation, it's the poorest states, the states with the most disrupted families, the most car accidents, the most pollution, and the lowest life expectancies are also those states that receive more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars, and are generally opposed to the federal government's activities. And Louisiana turned out to be an exaggerated version of the red state paradox. Second poorest state in the country. It had all those troubling rates. And 44% of the state budget came from the federal government. And yes, it's overwhelmingly suspicious of the government and very sympathetic to the Tea Party and very enthusiastic for Donald Trump. So my question was, what experiences lead to the feelings behind this position? And I left Berkeley, California, where I've long taught, which is a blue political bubble, to try and find a political bubble that's as far right as Berkeley is left, and to try and climb an empathy wall so that I can really climb into the shoes of people to whom this position makes sense. Over 5 years, that's what I did.
You know, Louisiana is sort of home to some of these horrible environmental disasters like the BP oil spill, but there's many others. There's the Bayou Corn sinkhole, which is this crazy industrial accident involving a salt dome thousands of feet below a bayou that sucked, like, I watched a video online, it sucks whole trees, just made this sort of sacrifice zone. But, you know, the folks there sort of struggle to sort of place blame on corporate malfeasance.
They don't place it on corporate malfeasance. That's what I was opening my ears to. What is their thinking? What's behind their thinking about that? I interviewed a man who, after Bayou Corn had been officially evacuated, was still living there. He couldn't bring himself to leave. He loved this community. And his interview with me began with his saying, you know, the problem with federal government is it takes community away. And, you know, we ought to have neighborly feeling and do for each other. And big government comes and offers services that replace neighborly help. And yet, in the course of his life, what happened to him was that it was an under-regulated industrial accident. It was an under-regulated industry, Texas brine, which drilled a hole into the bottom of a bayou and on down into the side of a salt dome, leading that side to collapse under the bayou and to draw the waters of the bayou down. And so he described what it was like. First, there were earthquakes where there had never been earthquakes before. Then, he said, I thought I was having a heart attack. Suddenly, everything was jiggly. Very alarmed by that. And then he began to notice methane gas. It was when it was raining, it was like Alka-Seltzer tablets in the puddles and became dangerous. What if you lit a match and there was an explosion? But he had a gas monitor in his garage. That's how much he didn't want to leave his home and was staying there. And there were boxes. He was eventually going to have to leave. But when I first interviewed him, that was the story. And he had suffered terribly from non-regulation. And what took his community away was not the presence of government, it was the absence of government or a countervailing force against and to regulate industry. And he was big Tea Party and big Trump supporter. I tried to really understand what the feeling about the government was. And in his case, partly the federal government represented the powerful North that was always wagging its moral finger at the South and blaming the sin of slavery on the South, on the present inhabitants of the South. And he felt, the carpetbaggers and even environmentalists he saw as kind of coming with in a scolding spirit. So that was the first thing. He saw the federal government as an instrument of the North. But the federal government, in his mind, was also an instrument of inept officials. And he took that idea from his experience with the Louisiana state government. And he had a real point on that, because it was not, in fact, really regulating polluters. So people are mad at the state. They say, wait a minute, why is my tax dollar going to pay people that aren't protecting me? Meanwhile, the companies are looking good because they seem to promise jobs, although there are very few permanent, well-paying jobs of this highly automated industry, petro and oil.
As you see it, how does that narrative fit into the view that environmental regulations are bad and can prevent freedom?
Well, there's something very poignant going on. And in the book, I point to the paradox that actually it's residents of red states that suffer the highest rate of pollution. The good people I met in Louisiana are, in fact, victims of pollution more than others. I came to feel that if you live in Berkeley, California, you use plastic objects, you you know, and you enjoy a clean environment. But in Louisiana, where these things are made and industries are permitted to pollute, and a population is made to adapt to that pollution, a giant sacrifice is being made, and paradoxically, the people suffering from it are, in a way, embracing that. And they do it, and I get to explore this in the book in different psychological ways. There were some who opposed regulating polluters, saying, my party's the Republican Party. The Republican Party opposes regulation, so I oppose regulation, including of polluters. So they did it out of loyalty to a party that they strongly identified with. Others took the position really of a cowboy. It was more personal. You know, I'm tough, you're tough, Mother Nature's tough, and a tendency to deny the destruction of the environment in that way. You know, we can take it. And there was some pride and a capacity to endure. And then there was a third that was more sacrificial in nature. It was a woman who, you know, basically she was very religious and was a valued, really, one's capacity to renounce wishes. Sometimes you had to give things up. We couldn't always have what we want. And it was in that spirit that she said, pollution is the sacrifice we make for capitalism. She loved clean environment. She was a great lover of nature, but she, so it wasn't a callous disregard or a hardening of heart toward the damage of polluters, but more a sacrificial orientation of, well, I really love the environment and I would like it to be clean. It matters. I understand this hurts. And children with rare brain cancers, no, this is terrible. But it's the sacrifice we make. So in those three ways, as the sort of the party loyalist or the cowboy or the worshiper in a way, were three psychological pathways through which people expressed an adaptation to pollution. And because they didn't see a way through of keeping the jobs they wanted and living with clean air and clean water, these two things can go together. There's a lot of research, and I refer to some of it in the book, that actually cleaning up the environment goes with a more vital economy. There are lots of different studies on this. Basically, that's the story, but it's not the story they lived with.
There's more of Reed Fraser's conversation with Arlie Hochschild, the author of Strangers in Their Own Land, on the Trump on Earth podcast. Listen to that and over 50 other episodes at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us at AlleghenyFront.org and on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.